BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Tomorrow's show will be a little bit special. It will be live from Boise, Idaho. The new World Pac-12. I'm doing a tour of the new Pac-12 cities and locations, and tomorrow's show will be the first of an ongoing series. And I plan to take you with me to some of the new World Pac-12 locations, and why not start with Boise State? So tomorrow's show from Boise, Idaho. We'll also get to Spokane, Washington, to Gonzaga's campus, and out to San Diego State and Utah State, and I'm going to go to Logan, Utah, and Fresno, and wherever else the Pac-12 adds schools from, we will take you there. And so tomorrow, for listeners who are into Boise State, I will be in Boise broadcasting tomorrow's show 3 to 6 p.m. right here across the network. Today I've got a special guest. If you read my column yesterday at johncanzano.com, you know about Wilbur Huckle. It's a name that I heard often growing up as my dad, who was a professional baseball player in the Mets organization, played seven seasons of minor league baseball and crossed paths in 1969 in Tidewater in AAA, the Mets affiliate there, with a character named Wilbur Huckle. I wrote about it. If you want to read more about it at johncanzano.com, check out that column. But my dad is reconnected with his old teammate, and I'm bringing my dad on the show here to talk about the legend of Wilbur Huckle. Now, I grew up hearing bedtime stories about this guy, freckle-faced, red-headed Mets prospect Wilbur Huckle, who also had a brief run for the presidential candidacy in 1964. It's kind of a gag that the Mets put on before teams started doing this kind of marketing. The Mets fans were way ahead of their time, but my dad here to talk about his minor league baseball experience, making his second appearance on the radio show. Dad, let's start with Wilbur Huckle. What would you tell people who don't know that name and don't know that character?
Well, first of all, he was a very special guy. He was special in a lot of ways. First of all, he was from Texas, and he had red hair and freckles, and he was stocky. He was one of a kind. He stood out in his appearance, and he's a very hard worker, always practicing, throwing batting practice, hitting, fielding. He did it all, and he was a great guy. You could count on him. So
let me ask you this. Okay, so you're in the New York Mets organization as a minor league player. You are in AAA when you encounter Wilbur Huckle. Now, you're both infielders. You're both minor league all-stars at earlier stops. He had had a cup of coffee, or at least not even a cup of coffee. He got to look at a cup of coffee in the big leagues early in his career. We'll get back to that later. But what was that like, the camaraderie like between players on the team, and you had guys coming and going all the time in the minor leagues in the 1960s?
Well, in A-ball, they ran guys through there like 30, 40 in a season and releasing guys after a month or two, and they figured out they couldn't play. So by the time you get to AAA, those guys have been around for 2 to 4 to 5 years usually, and so they've been through all the different seasons, all the hard work of A-ball playing every day, which most of them have never done for months before. I know I didn't, and you know, fatigue is a big part of it. So anyway, there was a saying that the guys that were in AAA, the more they played, the more years they played, the better the guys were. So I think that had something to do with it as well. So Huckle, I had heard about Huckle when I got to AAA, but I really didn't know him. And then 1969, Clyde McCullough was the manager, and Jack Tracy and Wilbur Huckle was on the team. Huckle was an infielder. I was an infielder. And we were both reserves. And so we just wanted to get into the lineup. And Huckle had a ton of energy. Very unusual in that respect. He was going constantly from the time he woke up till the game was over. So we became roommates, and he would get up first thing in the morning, which is very unusual in baseball. Usually you sleep till late morning. He was up like 7-8 o'clock, dressed and ready to go out, and he'd get you up, and we'd have to walk all over town. He had every sporting goods store in every city we went in. There was 10 different cities, so he just wear you out, you know. He had constant energy, constant motion.
And he was a guy, he was the one you told me he used to jump rope while he was watching TV.
He watched TV, he'd be jumping rope, talking. I remember one time he was jumping rope. It was a time when they were releasing people, and he was saying, as he jumped rope, you know, Tony, there's a lot of ways to make a buck besides baseball. Looking at the TV, jumping rope furiously. So he was a special guy. He was very unusual.
You talked fondly of him. When I was a kid, I can remember bedtime stories where you would talk about, you know, he was the guy that was making jokes on the road trip and lighting the cigarette, the exploding cigarette gag, and he was always kind of hamming it up and making it fun. Amid that, though, like, you had a story from, I think it was 1968 or 69, Tidewater. John Matlack, young pitcher who was a rising prospect, comes to that team. He went on to pitch in the big leagues and made 3 All-Star games, but Matlack, what was the deal? He didn't like to throw inside?
Yeah, he was afraid to throw inside. He was a big bonus baby, number one pick, I think. Got big money. And but he wouldn't pitch inside, so Clyde took him down to the bullpen and said, I want you to pitch inside and brush people back and even hit them. It's okay. So they needed a volunteer to be the batter while Matlack tried this.
Did Matlack throw hard?
Yeah, he had a good fastball. Left-handed pitcher, which they loved. And so Huckle volunteered with great enthusiasm, went out to the bullpen, put his batting helmet on, and Matlack tried to knock him down, and he couldn't. He may have hit Huckle once or twice, but that's about it.
Now, are you watching this when it's happening?
Yeah, we're watching and laughing, so it was special.
All right, so let's fast forward. You, after 7 seasons, decide you're not coming back. You're not gonna continue to play baseball. You know, you'd been traded to the Montreal Expos organization. Huckle, who was several years older than you, did he ever tell you how old he was?
It was a secret. He kept it a secret. I thought he was a year or two older. Turns out he was a lot older than us. And when I talked to him the other day, he even said I kept it a secret. Yeah.
You didn't talk to him for how long?
About 40 years.
So 40 years. You guys don't communicate. And you brought him up. And I can remember looking him up years ago. And he was in San Antonio, Texas. I think that's where he grew up or where he was from. So how does he get in touch with you after 40 years?
His daughter sent me a text message indicating that maybe we should talk and that here's Huckle's phone number. So I took advantage of that. I gave him a call a couple days later, and we went from there. We've talked twice. The last time for over an hour. So
give me an idea what that's like for you to have that, you know, span in time. And
it's like we weren't apart that many years. It's like you talk to him maybe 30 days later, you know.
Yeah.
And he he was really easy to talk to. He asked about what I was doing. I asked about what he was doing, and he surprised me. He said he lived on 600 acres, and he was a wildlife manager. Made him provide feed and water for wildlife, and he went from there. He got three tractors, and
Did that really surprise you, though, that a guy that was that busy?
No, not at all.
In his 80s?
He's still fishing, you know. He loved to fish, and I don't know about hunting, but, he was an outdoor guy, and I guess he's he's helping a high school team coach.
Baseball.
So Wilbur Huckle, in 1964, gets brought up late in the season. The Mets are having a horrible season. Casey Stengel's the manager. The Mets are on their way to losing 109 games that year. They were 53-109. Terrible team. You were in the organization. Did they just not have players?
No.
Because you came in 65.
Yeah.
A year later. But did they not have players in 63?
Mets 64? Originated in 63, so yeah. No, they didn't have players. And he had been talked about as a prospect on the radio at the Mets game, I guess, and the fans loved his name.
Wilbur Huckle,
and they decided that they would run him for president. Wilbur Huckle for president.
Yeah.
Metropolitan Party, and they made a pin that said Wilbur Huckle for president. I ended up buying that pin on eBay.
Yeah.
And I asked Huckle, how'd that come about? And he said, I had no idea. I didn't know what was happening.
He was the perfect candidate to run against Barry Goldwater, because Goldwater was from Arizona, senator from Arizona, very conservative, and Wilbur Huckle from the Metropolitan Party, the New York Metropolitan Party, running for president. You understand why people would find that funny. But let's talk about that season, because you talked to Huckle. He said in 64, he gets called up. The Mets are having a historically bad season. They're going to lose 109 games. Casey Stengel, the manager of the Mets at the time, they're playing at the Polo Grounds. So are the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds. For 2 years, the Mets and Giants shared that stadium, I think.
Mm.
And Huckle walks in to his first day at the stadium, and Willie Mays and McCovey are in the outfield during batting practice, or how did that go?
Yeah, Huckle said that the locker room was out in center field, and so to get to the dugout, you'd have to go through center field, and when he opened the door to go to the dugout, there was Willie Mays and Willie McCovey standing there, and he said McCovey was huge. You never seen a guy that big.
Really?
And then Willie Mays turned to him and said, "Hey, Rook, my name's Willie Mays."
Yeah.
He introduced himself. "What's your name?" And so he thought that was a highlight. He also, when he first got to the Mets, the locker room, everybody was gone except for one guy. It was Duke Snyder. And Duke came up to him and introduced himself. And Huckle was impressed with that. So, you know, years later, Duke Snyder was my manager in the Northwest League. Great, great guy.
What was he like as a manager?
Oh, easygoing, happy. He's one of the best managers I ever had. He knew how to handle people. And I admired him very much.
So he, at that time, he had to be how old when you were?
It was 1966, so I imagine he was in his 40s.
All right, so he's in his 40s. Did he ever get in the cage and hit? Did you get to see him swing the bat?
What a hitter. Yeah, he was, they had an old-timers game, and so he went out there, was in Eugene, actually, and he went out there and hit two or three homers in a row. He just pumped him over the right field fence. He was a natural hitter. I asked him, "Duke, how do you hit?" And he told me, "It's simple. You just put the fat part of the bat on the ball." He had no clues. Yeah. Natural hitter.
I think sometimes for those guys that it came very natural to have a hard time teaching it, right?
Yeah. They don't know how it's happening. They just know it's easy.
Best managers you had, were they great players? Or, I mean, I guess Duke Snyder, or were they guys who struggled?
Both. Snyder was, you know, Hall of Famer and a great manager. I had Clyde McCullough that was, you know, he played in the big leagues, but he wasn't, defensively he was really good, but he wasn't a great hitter. Chuck Hiller was a great manager, and he played in the World Series with the Giants, but not a Hall of Famer. And I had a few others, receivers, Ken Deal is a pitcher, and that's all I can think of right now.
The time in which you played, you know, I think we talked about this before. You played with some really good players, or were in spring training with some great players, and then played against some players. What do you remember? Don Baylor was in. Is that the Carolina League?
No, it was in AAA. Okay. He was in Rochester.
Okay, so he's in Rochester. What do you remember of Don Baylor?
Big, strong guy. Lots of muscles. And not built like a ball player, more built like a football player. Mm-hmm. There was Bobby Gritch, who was an infielder.
Yep.
That was very impressive. Who else was in there?
Bobby Bonds was in that.
Bobby Bonds, Barry's dad, who was 18 years old in the Carolina League and hit 40 homers and hit 300. He was a man amongst boys.
Wow.
Who else? The Carlton Fisk catcher.
You got a fight with Carlton Fisk.
Well, indirectly. It was a fight with another guy who came into second base, and I didn't like it. And he stood up and called me by the wrong name, and I was insulted because...
What do you mean he called you by the wrong name?
He called me Carthel.
Yeah.
And I was in the league 3 years.
You
we had won the pennant. He didn't know who I was.
Yeah.
So I punched him. And then Carlton Fisk came out.
Yeah.
It was a big... Both Donnie dugouts empty.
Yeah. So, but did you mix it up with Fisk?
Should never call somebody by the wrong name.
Don't call him by the wrong name. I thought he called you a bad name. He just called
no.
you by the wrong name.
Wrong name.
Worse yet.
Hey, I was trying to get in the lineup. I finally got in. He doesn't know who I am.
Yeah. So he took it out on him. Now, Fisk, there's a photograph in a newspaper, and you and Fisk, like, the shirt's torn off or the jersey's torn and the buttons are popped off.
Yeah.
Were you wrestling around with Fisk?
No. You know, it was like... we were fighting at second base, and then it was like an avalanche when the dugouts came out and knocked us over, and I was on the bottom of the group of the pile.
Yeah.
I crawled out. I ended up in center field, and I looked, turned around, looked, and there's Carlton Fisk, and he says, "You little shit." And so that was the Carlton Fisk thing.
All right, so what about you hit a home run off Louis Tiant? And
you know, I hit a home run off Matlack, too.
Oh, yeah.
That was sweet. Yeah,
okay.
Louis Tiant.
All right, let's go back to Matlack, because you had hit a home run off Matlack. It was the day you were traded, right?
I was traded. I changed dugouts because we were playing them on the road.
Yeah.
I think it was my second at bat. I had a home run over the center field fence, and that was very sweet because he was a bonus baby.
Yeah.
We were all... Scrum guys.
Yeah.
And the manager, who was Hank Bauer.
Yeah.
You know, he had a hard time playing a lot of his players. He just played the regulars. He's trying to get back to the big leagues, I guess.
So he was trying to win games.
And it was nice to hit a home run and say, "Hey, you made a mistake."
When you're rounding the bases there, are you thinking about that?
Or? Oh, yeah.
did anybody say anything to you as you were going around the bases?
No.
Because those are your teammates. Those are your teammates hours earlier.
I know. It's very awkward. Even when I went in, you know, you change uniforms.
Yeah.
You get out of your locker. You get your bats and your equipment. Yeah. And you're trying to say goodbye to people, but really you're in shock.
Yeah.
And now you're a leper. They don't want to touch you. You're not their teammate anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was It's very weird.
Yeah. And you had a homer. Did you go 3 for 4 that day?
I went 2 for 4.
2 for 4.
Single and a homer.
Single and a home run. When we come back, I want to ask you about the home run that you hit off Louis Tiant. I think it's a good story. Plus, it comes up often on this show, umpiring, youth sports. I want to know from a perspective of somebody who's played professional baseball kind of what you see happening or maybe how you viewed youth sports umpires, after your baseball career. Stick around. Part 2 with my dad coming up.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
We've been telling stories this hour. I got my dad to sit down for an interview. He has reconnected with a former professional baseball teammate of his, Wilbur Huckle. If you didn't get a chance to read my column, you can read it at johncanzano.com. It'll explain a lot of the backstory as to why we were having this conversation today. We will get Wilbur Huckle on this show. It is my mission to get him on the show this week and let him tell stories and ask him about that look at a cup of coffee that he got in 1964 when he got called up to the big leagues in the late part of the season with the New York Mets. Casey Stengel's team made a big league roster, never appeared in a big league game, didn't get an at-bat, didn't get to go into the field, didn't get a pinch run assignment. And this for a team that lost 109 baseball games in 1964. I've got my dad sitting down for an interview. Dad, I want to ask you about Louis Tiant. Mm-hmm. Go to that at-bat. What do you remember about Louis?
Louis had a weird lineup. He'd wind up and he'd turn his back to you.
Yeah.
And you'd think, oh my God, you know, where is this guy going to throw the ball? He's not even looking. And he had a great curveball. So I intended to hit his curveball. So I was going up to the bat, I'm going to hit his curveball. Because you can't go up and say, I'm going to hit his fastball curveball, because then you hit nothing.
Yeah.
So I'm going to sit on his curveball.
Well, so you're looking curveball.
I'm looking curveball. It's about the second or third pitch in the at-bat, and he throws me a fastball about shoulder or letter high on the outside corner. And, I wasn't a great hitter, so I swung at it and expecting a curveball and got a fastball.
And
I hit
swung.
It. I swung.
Inexplicably.
Don't even trust myself, you know?
Yeah.
And I hit a fly ball to right field, and it went over the right field fence. Next time up, I said, I'm going to hit his curveball.
Yeah.
He throws me a curveball, and I hit a double to left center. So my mom and dad are in the stands, and I go 4 for 5 with 2 doubles, a home run, and a single. So that was a good day.
Off Louis Tiant.
Yep.
That's fantastic. All right, so you, how many of these guys did you stay in touch with? Because it felt like when it was over, guys just scattered.
They did. They scattered, and I got a call from another teammate a few years after, and it was very awkward. We couldn't connect.
Yeah.
You know?
You had nothing to talk about, or?
It just wasn't.
Yeah.
We're not in sync, you know?
Yeah.
And, but Huckle was different, you know? I roomed with him. I understood him. He was the a major part of the team even when he wasn't playing because he was entertaining everybody. And just a good guy.
Before I let you go here, I want to ask you about two guys that people know that are in the Hall of Fame, Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan. What your memories were of seeing those guys, or did you face them, or did you just go to spring training with them, or... Let's start with Ryan, because he threw hard, but what was he like as a young player?
Well, I didn't know him well. He threw really hard, harder than anybody, and he was wild. And so the Mets were trying to get him to come up with some control, so they sent him to spring training in the minor league ballpark, and I was playing shortstop behind him. And what I remember is there was a right-handed hitter, and Ryan threw his fastball and hit him in the ribs. And the guy was in agony. You know, it was probably 100-mile-an-hour yeah. fastball. And Seaver came down to the minor league camp because he needed work. He came down with Duffy Dyer, his catcher, and pitched like 3 innings against us in a simulated game. And I think I popped up. I got one at bat, I popped up. But what I remember about him is his slider. Slider was, it looked like it didn't have the slider spin on it. It just come shoot over. It's hard to recognize. Mm. His fastball was really good, but not like his slider. His slider was something special.
The Mets had all that pitching at that time. Was that in, like, were they just drafting and signing guys, or what were they doing?
Yeah, those guys were drafted. I think Atlanta had something to do with Seaver, and somehow the baseball decided that Atlanta couldn't have him, and the Mets got him.
And Seaver used to throw. He would get way down low. He was all legs, wasn't he?
Yeah, thick legs. He wasn't that tall, maybe 5'10", 5'11", my guess. But he was, when he delivered the ball, he was low with thick thighs. So.
And then Ryan, what was it like to play shortstop behind Nolan Ryan?
Well, it was pretty boring. You know, he either struck him out or... yeah. So, not much going on there.
Now, you had a game in the Carolina League. It was a playoff game. Remember, there was an end of the season. I think you guys were tied with somebody. There was one game to break the tie. And you had a Carolina League record for assists in a game. It was some ridiculous amount of chances that you had playing shortstop. I want to ask, what do you remember of that? As I look it up, I'll look up the...
The pitcher that we had was Bethke. Forget his first name. Jim Bethke.
Yeah.
And he was a sinker ball pitcher. So that had a lot to do with it. So when the other team hit his fastball, usually it'd be a grounder. So I had, I think I had 12 assists in that game as a shortstop, which I think the record was 11. Mm. It was a playoff game.
Yeah. I do see it here. 12 assists.
Yeah. And I didn't even know, you know.
September 8th, 1967.
Yeah, it was late in the season. And I didn't know what was going on. I really, until after the game was over and somebody said something.
But is that a fun game where you're just, it's like every other ground ball is?
Yeah, because, you know, you're busy and you get in a rhythm and it just flows.
Okay.
You know.
So I want to ask you something that comes up all the time on this show, and it's about umpiring and officiating. And I think maybe your experience as a professional baseball player helped you maybe later when you were coaching Little League or you're a parent of a bunch of kids. Did you get a different kind of vantage point of watching the umpires, trying to get it right, understanding that they would make mistakes? Like, how did that shape you later? Because I don't remember you in Little League yelling at umpires and being upset with guys.
No, you know, umpires, the professional umpires would even say, when you question a call, I missed it, you know. So what are you going to do? They missed it. They made a mistake. You just move on. And I remember one time, and at bat, John McSherry was the umpire.
He went to the big leagues.
He was a good umpire. And anyway, the pitcher threw the ball about ankle high and 6 inches outside, and he called it a strike. And I turned to him and I said, "That's a strike?" He said, "Yeah." Of course he said, "Yeah."
Right.
Next pitch, pitcher throws it same place. And of course I have to swing at it because I don't know what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And I ground out the second, and I'm thinking, well, you know, the umpire just got me out.
Yeah.
So, and with kids, these poor umpires, you know, they're volunteers doing the best they can. And I've even had some pitchers that were questioning the umpires' balls and strikes calls all the time, and I called him over and I said, look, you can't beg this umpire. Just throw strikes and go from there. Do the best you can. So it was more of a teaching thing than a discipline beat you up type thing. And I remember a football game between two high school teams. One was a perennial winner and the other was a ordinary win-loss team. And a guy would come off the field, and on the ordinary team, the coach would grab his face mask and shake it and yell at him. The other team that was the winner, the player would come off the field, and you could read the coach's lips what happened. So he was teaching them. Big difference. So that's what I tried to do.
All right, Dad, I appreciate you making an appearance on this show and sharing some of your stories. We're going to get Wilbur Huckle on.
Good.
We're going to get him on the show. But
let me ask
you one question. There's a story. Now, you had a manager that was upset with a losing streak. And so right after the game, he makes a beeline to the clubhouse, the story goes. But Wilbur Huckle, as you said, was always the first guy in there to take a shower, first guy dressed.
First guy dressed.
Yeah. So
first guy leaving.
What happens?
First guy there.
You guys have lost like 8 or 9 in a row. Who is the manager?
Kirby Farrell, I think.
Okay.
Now, this is a story I heard. I wasn't
okay.
there.
Okay. Oh, you weren't there. Okay. No. Tell me the story.
So Kirby Farrell gets the clubhouse together, and he says, nobody make a move. You just lost 10 games in a row. We're going to fix this, and nobody's going to go in the shower until I'm done. And he's standing there, and behind him, out of the shower comes Wilbur Huckle with a towel around him.
I love that. That belongs in a movie. I love that. I'm going to ask him about that. We're going to get him on later in the week. So
great.
I think he'd be delighted to come on. Thank you for sharing that.
Okay.
I'm glad that you connected with your old friend.
Yeah, me too.
All right, leave it here. You got the Bald-Faced Truth statewide.